by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering some of these protest movements that have been going on for weeks. And the first one are the Yellow Vest. And we're going to have, play a small clip, a short clip of a documentary that was done over there in France. Now, there's some French in there, you know, some French language quotes by individuals. But I'm going to go back after we play this clip, and I'm going to sort of look at the video and then repeat what some of those French, you know, quotations were. So this will give you an idea, but it's a very, very good idea. The French are not only protesting about the added tax on the gasoline, but there's a lot of underlying problems the French are having with the so-called elites and the people that are in control of France. So here's this clip and listen carefully.
What is wrong with France?
Aujourd'hui, toute l'élite est en train de tuer le peuple français.
The nation built by rebellions, once again engulfed by the anger of its people against power.
Il faut arrêter de prendre les gens pour des imbéciles. Stop. Moi, je dis stop.
For 7 days in December, we joined the so-called Yellow Vests movement in the streets and roundabouts across France to try and understand the grievances that have pushed people over the brink and discover just where they are ready to take their revolt. The pole of his flag is something Patrick can afford to lose. But there are things the 58-year-old is not ready to accept in modern-day France.
Gardez-le en souvenir, le manche. Hein.
Quand on voit des gens sur les routes qui sont, qui ont pas de logement, plein la misère de partout, quoi. Le prix d'achat, tout est cher. Les gens à la retraite, c'est vraiment dur pour tout le monde.
But why do you blame Macron? What exactly is he doing?
Parce que Macron, c'est un con.
Non, il faut pas le considérer comme ça.
Ah bon? J'ai dit une connerie?
Non.
Ah si! C'est un con! C'est à cause de lui qu'on est là!
C'est pas spécialement Macron.
Macron, t'es un con!
C'est le système.
Ouais, le système.
Qui nous empoisonne, on arrive à s'en sortir. Quand on voit vraiment nos dirigeants, le privilège de payer des costumes à 45 000 euros. Parce que les 45 000 euros, ça fait deux ans de salaire, trois ans, et ça fait des salaires de trois personnes par an. Mais on a de quoi vraiment se révolter. On nous pique tout. On nous pique tout et nous, à la fin, nous, on a rien. Pourtant, on a rien. On nous fait encore des poches, mais ça fait mal.
This group of friends came from the suburbs of Paris to join the so-called Yellow Vests, the movement that has shaken France to its core and reawakened the country's revolutionary fervor. David says it's much simpler than that. It's about denouncing government policies, he says, are making people's lives impossible.
On est étranglés de taxes. Il y en a marre de ces injustices sociales. On donne toujours aux plus riches et on prend toujours à la classe moyenne et à la classe pauvre. Ça ne peut pas continuer.
The Yellow Vests movement arose against a hike in fuel taxes proposed by the French government to encourage a transition towards greener forms of energy. But the social uprising has widened to include some of France's most bitter grievances, The resentment of an entire part of the population that has been feeling excluded for far too long. On Saturday, December 1st, for the third time in as many weeks, thousands took to the streets across France to say their time is now.
Pourquoi c'est magnifique? Parce qu'on se bat pour notre liberté.
A fight, precisely what the government wanted to avoid, erupted once again. And Paris ended up immersed in chaos. Something else demonstrators blamed authorities for.
Here are some of the quotes from the actual documentary. And I think it's important to be able to see this. They're treating the people like we're idiots, was one of the quotes, okay? And we've had enough of it. We've just had enough of it, is what you see in the streets of Paris all the time. Euronews produced this, and so some of the dates about when some of the first protests went on or back in December and so forth. But it's still going on, and there was a big protest today in Paris. So what the people have been saying on the streets, France's Days of Rage or one of the ways it's being presented. And there was one man who the police confronted him. He had a pole, and on the end of the pole, they gave him his flag, his French flag, see. But they wouldn't let him continue to protest with that pole, see. And so there are people in the streets without a home, he says. There's misery everywhere. The cost of living, everything is so expensive. Pensioners are struggling. It's hard for everyone, they go on and on, to make a living and so forth. Because Macron, no, we shouldn't speak like that. They even argue among themselves about Macron and so forth and so forth. So this is what is going on in France today. It's not necessarily about Macron. It's his policies, not individually as a person. They're not arguing about that, but they're arguing about his policies, which have resulted in them not being able. He says they afford suits that cost, you know, all kinds of francs. He says one black Frenchman. We have reasons to revolt. They're taking away everything from us. This black, revolting person, this activist says that's rallied here in front of the Arc de Triomphe. So they're rallying around there on the Arc de Triomphe and so forth. And they are just sick and tired of this whole thing. That's basically what's going on here. And they can't make a living. This Euronews is interviewing one Frenchman here. It's about the cost of living, he says. We're strangled by taxes and we're fed up with the social system. We're constantly taking away from the middle and lower classes. And that's what the people are saying. So it was as much of a lower middle class, upper middle class revolt as it is anything. So it's coming from the grassroots. Some of the information I've received is that the jobs are in the major metropolitan areas in France, but many of the people still live in the rural areas and they need inexpensive gas as cheaply as they can get to go to and from those metropolitan cities to work. So the housing is still in these small villages in the outskirts. Now, I want to get into a book that I've been reading off and on for a number of months, if not years, and it's called Fire in the Minds of Men. And it's an excellent book on the revolutionaries. And many of these revolutionaries in over the last 200 to 300 years, much of the communist socialist movement came out of France before Marx, Karl Marx or Engels were involved in the movement itself. And so that's what we're up against, is that France has a long history, see, of revolt, going back to the 1700s into the 1800s. And some of that culminated and finally manifested in the French Revolution, even though the intelligentsia of France, Bonneville and them were meeting at the Palace Royal there in Paris, and they were creating all kinds of publications and so forth. And they actually were behind the revolution, these kinds of revolutionary writers and philosophers and political scientists, the first political scientists, you could say. And so they're the ones that really got the revolution going. And then later on, Marx and Engels would pick up out of the German. He'd say Marx came out of Germany and Engels came out of England. And they finally got together and took over some of the ideas using Hegel's, you could say, dialectic. Marx applied the social classes of the working man against the owners of the businesses and the bourgeois and so forth. And that's where he started creating his ideas, which had virtually swept over Western civilization. But with that said, the big money wants that, the big money, the ultimate money in the world has the collective, communist collective under control. So they control the opposition to create and continue to divide the population as a whole so that they can continue to manipulate, but they'll never let the left or the communist left have a money power. And so they use money power to continue the division. And so that's on and on. But anyway, that's what's going on. I'm coming up next with some clips from Tucker Carlson about, you know, emergency powers that the president might have. Colonel McGregor is coming up next with what he has to say about if President Trump does exercise an emergency concerning the border. And so that might be very, very true. He's going to speak next Tuesday before Congress, and it's going to be a State of the Union address to Congress as a whole within the House itself. So that will be coming up next Tuesday. And so that will be on the 5th. So watch for that. Now, coming up next is Tucker Carlson interviewing Colonel McGregor, and he's really a fine retired colonel that knows what's going on. So listen carefully what this man said, because he knows what the heck he's talking about. Here we go now.
The government shutdown has ended for the moment temporarily, but the battle over a border wall continues. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has vowed that she will never fund that wall under any circumstances. The president promises he's going to build one. So that seems to leave the White House with one option: declare a national emergency and order the building of a wall our southern border. That sounds like a pretty radical solution. But is it? Well, it turns out that national emergencies happen all the time, and somehow very few of them receive any attention at all. In 1976, Congress passed the National Emergencies Act. That law grants the president the power to declare a state of emergency in response to virtually anything if he thinks it's necessary. National emergencies can be renewed annually and routinely are. Congress could only block a state of emergency with a two-thirds vote. So it's a very broad law, and it's been applied a lot. It began in 1979. President Jimmy Carter declared a national emergency to keep Iranian government property from entering the United States. That emergency is still ongoing, despite being older than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example. Since that date, American presidents have declared no fewer than 58 national emergencies, and 31 of them are still ongoing right now. The average state of emergency in this country has lasted for 9.5 years. So what are some of these emergencies? Well, some really were emergencies. September 2001, for example, President Bush announced a state of emergency that gave the White House greater authority to mobilize the military, call out the National Guard, and perform other counter-terrorist actions. That emergency has been dutifully renewed each of the past 18 years. So that was real. We've also had a decade-long national emergency to combat the swine flu. President Trump has declared 3 national emergencies already. Bet you didn't know that. One of them sanctioned those who use social media to influence elections, those dastardly Macedonians. Another national emergency condemned the government of Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. That was a national emergency. And yet another ongoing national emergency punishes anyone who works to, quote, undermine the sovereignty of Lebanon. You see the point here? in Washington, protecting the sovereignty of a faraway Middle Eastern country that very few Americans will ever go to qualifies as a national emergency. Protecting our own country's sovereignty is, quote, immoral. And we're not overstating that. Just this week, four freshman Democrats in the House co-signed a letter demanding lower funding for America's border enforcement. In other words, it is virtuous to protect others. It is wrong to protect ourselves and our own children. What's the name for that attitude? Well, self-hatred would be one. Should people who hate the country be in charge of it? Douglas McGregor is a retired U.S. Army colonel who has worked to defend the country, author of the book Margin of Victory. He joins us tonight. Colonel, thank you very much for coming on.
Good.
Do you think it's wise for the president to declare a national emergency to secure the border?
Yeah, absolutely, without question. I mean, if you've got 30 million illegal residents inside your country who violated your borders, disregarded the rule of law, you've got a national emergency. We've had this for many years. So that's absolutely the case. Secondly, only the president can address this. He has the constitutional authority to do so. What he needs is an executive order on, modeled on what I have written and I think is now widely appreciated inside the Fox News community, that effectively says, look, Secretary of the Army, your mission is to secure the border. You've got 30 days. Use whatever forces you need. We'll write up the rules of engagement. We'll provide you with whatever funding is necessary, but you will secure the border. Now, while the Army does that, we can proceed with building barriers. We also have an organization called the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they can be tasked to build barriers. All of the funds necessary to do this can be released.
Flood control.
Well, they have flood control missions and all sorts of missions inside the United States, but the point is you have Army forces that are engineers. Brigades of engineers that can be put to work on the border and build barriers. He doesn't need special permission. He has the constitutional authority to act as the commander-in-chief. He doesn't need any help from Congress at all. And so this is a national emergency. Let there be no doubt about it.
You're confusing me because I live here, and it was my understanding that the point of the U.S. Armed Forces was to guarantee the sovereignty of countries we'll never visit and can't spell. That's not the case. The sovereignty of Lebanon, for example.
Yeah, well, look, here's good news. We have thousands of soldiers, sergeants, lieutenants, captains, majors, lieutenant colonels, who have guarded and secured other people's borders. So they know exactly how to do this. All we're trying to do is defend our own borders. And when you defend it, you defend it. Someone tries to cross your border illegally, you stop them. Once you stop them, you can biometrically tag them. So you have them in a database, and you turn them around and send them back. And you tell them, if you come back again, you will face prison time. You will be prosecuted for violating our laws. That's how you expel people. You don't just leave your borders open and say, here's a camp, move into it while we decide what to do with you. The president can outline these legal restrictions in an executive border order. And he needs to do it as soon as possible.
So this would not be the first time that the U.S. military has secured the American borders. I mean, that's why we have a military.
Yeah, the Army was there from 1846 to 1946.
Exactly. So why are White House lawyers telling the president that he does not have the authority to do that?
Oh, that's an easy answer. Because the president has surrounded himself for the last 2 years with people who are there to subvert him, to obstruct his agenda. Everyone is there to tell him no. And that's not an answer that he should accept. He has the authority. He needs to act. I was glad to see that he took the Secretary of the Army with him to visit the border when he went down to Texas. I hope the Secretary of the Army is thinking about this because that's his job.
Does the Secretary of the Army have constitutional authority to make policy?
No, but he has a constitutional obligation and mission to defend the borders of the United States.
Right.
It's going to get dicey because McGregor, what McGregor is saying, he's right on top of it. He's a hardline right conservative. And so he says that they have the authority under emergency conditions to stop those people. So anyway, coming up next is Getz, and he's been interviewed by Tucker also. It's a clip about the lying that's going on in Congress, and I think you're going to enjoy that. So here we go coming up next.
Roger Stone could die in prison for the crime of lying to Congress. Turns out others have lied to Congress, too. Are they going to die in prison? One congressman has an idea about that. He joins us next to explain. Well, the Mueller investigation sure knows how to make a splash. You hear nothing from them for months, and then bam, one morning they're on CNN with guns. A week ago, before dawn, an army of rifle and flashbang-toting federal agents descended on the home of poor Roger Stone. They dragged him away barefoot. The crime that justified this military-style capture of a 66-year-old man? Lying to Congress. But wait a second. People lie to Congress all the time. We live here. We can tell you that. And almost none of them ever get charged with anything. Should that change? Congressman Matt Gaetz represents the state of Florida, and he joins us tonight. Congressman, am I imagining this, or is lying to Congress as common as the sun rising? Is anyone ever charged?
It happens daily. Yeah. Yeah, I thought Robert Mueller was supposed to be investigating Russia collusion. Now he's become a glorified hall monitor enforcing the provisions of lying to Congress. The problem, Tucker, is that he's enforcing them unequally. And so I'm introducing the Justice for All Act, which would create criminal referrals for the other people that we know have lied to Congress. Hillary Clinton said that she didn't send or receive any classified email. We know that's a lie. Jim Comey said he was never the source or never the director of leaked information. He later admitted that that was not true, even though it was the subject of his sworn testimony before Congress. And you'll remember Clapper told all the American people before Congress that there was no bulk collection of data. The deputy director of the FBI, Mr. McCabe, he lied four times. He lied so frequently he was demoted and referred for criminal prosecution, but a whole lot of these other people haven't been. And it's the greatest evidence that Robert Mueller is not a person in search of the truth. He's out to get Trump and the people close to Trump, because if he was unbiased, you would have seen similar charges brought against these other people. Instead, he sends an army bigger than the force that killed bin Laden to go chase down Roger Stone in Fort Lauderdale.
Amazing. So you're going to refer all that to the Department of Justice. I hope you will come back and tell us what happens, by the way. I think that will be deeply revealing. Congressman Matt Gaetz, Florida. Good to see you.
Coming up next is an explanation by Roger Stone himself about what, you know, how they raided his house and so forth. And we've just got to try to wake up to what's going on out here. There was no need to do whatsoever what they did when they arrested Roger Stone. But here we go now, an explanation by him, first person. Here we go now.
Well, since the arrest of longtime Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone, the press has rallied around the people who arrested him and around a very specific interpretation of events. It was completely justified, they say, for the FBI to show up with enough armed agents to overthrow a Central American country. And if Stone says he was upset by all that, well, he must be lying.
FBI had information that he might try to destroy evidence. So they went in, I think, with an appropriate level of apprehension.
They had every reason to believe he was going to destroy evidence. He had threatened witnesses, or a witness at least, and he was playing hardball back.
How does this differ from other people surrounding a house for a raid from the FBI? I don't think it's that different. Right. By the way, the guy spent the entire day in front of news cameras. Clearly he was traumatized.
Who would put that mud guy on TV? I mean, it's really just a disgrace, I would say. The former CIA director, John Brennan, speaking of disgrace, insinuated that Stone was Hannibal Lecter's long-lost cousin. Watch this.
What happened with Roger Stone was in keeping with the standard operating procedures of the FBI. They were conducting an arrest and executing a search warrant. And let's not forget, Roger Stone has a fair amount of sort of unstable activities and comments that he had made. Stealing someone's dog, telling somebody, Randy Credico, prepare to die. This is not somebody that you want to trifle with.
You don't trifle him. Now, Brennan, the guy you just saw talking, once lied to the public, you, me, and the rest of us, about killing civilians with drone bombs. But that's not a big deal, really. He's still got a cable contract. So what does Roger Stone have to say about the coverage of his arrest? Well, we're going to ask him. He is on the set tonight. Roger Stone, thank you for joining us. Aren't
Great
you
under
a gag order?
No, actually, the judge said today that she's considering one. She asked for the government and for my attorneys to submit their thoughts about that. I'm going to refrain from speaking about the specifics of the indictment because I think I have addressed it to the extent that I'm going to. But I'm very interested in what's happened here, because one of my neighbors has now signed a sworn affidavit who was out walking their dog. And the CNN crew, their truck, showed up roughly a half an hour, 35 minutes before the FBI. I live on a dead-end street. The street was sealed, but they were allowed to stay in position right in front of my house. Now, if I was dangerous, which is the premise of this raid, why were they allowed to stay within the danger zone? Why were they put in harm's way? the idea that I'm a flight risk is ridiculous. I don't have a valid passport. Although I support the Second Amendment, I don't own a gun. There were no firearms in the house. And I've been under investigation for 2 years. So what information did the FBI have that I would destroy evidence? Why would I wait till?
Well, I don't know.
Friday?
John Brennan, who is a liar.
John Brennan, who
did
perjure. But
he says you're a dog kidnapper.
Well, look, again, that's in the indictment, and I will address it at an appropriate time because it's not true. But, first of all, I've written extensively on animal welfare rights for the Daily Caller and have worked very hard to stop the government from conducting inhumane scientific experiments on dogs and cats.
You're a dog lover of the first water.
But more importantly, John Brennan perjured himself twice before the Congress, once regarding the role of the Steele dossier and the FISA warrants, and secondarily regarding his breaking into the computers of a Senate committee looking into illegal torture by the CIA.
Yeah, just lying but about killing people with drones. Not a big deal.
But,
okay?
he's not being prosecuted like Mr. Comey, Mr. McCabe, Rod Rosenstein, Mr. Ray. General Clapper, of course, who said that, well, no, there's no metadata collection process. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton herself.
So
those people have perjured themselves, but I'm being prosecuted for perjury.
Well, they never gave the finger to the man, though. And that may be your main crime,
that,
in my view.
Be.
But let me ask you about the day of the arrest.
Yes.
So that was, I guess, a week ago today. You said that CNN remained within the security perimeter.
Yes.
During a raid that clearly they must have considered dangerous because they had automatic weapons. At least one arresting officer had two rifles with him and a sidearm. It's a lot of guns. How do you think CNN was allowed to stay there? How does that make sense?
I don't know, and I hope Senator Lindsey Graham and the House Republicans will get to the bottom of that because I'd like to know who signed off on this raid. I mean, look, the main reason that the gag order concerns me is because I need to be able to raise the money to mount a defense.
Right.
They have unlimited taxpayer dollars, three platoons of Ivy League left-wing lawyers to prosecute me. They have just given us an enormous amount of material in discovery that we have to go through, 3 terabytes, according to their press release. Unless people can go to stonedefensefund.com, and unless I have a forum to promote it, I can't possibly raise enough money.
So I don't understand. On what grounds could they just end your First Amendment rights?
Well, they, as you know, they gagged Paul Manafort in his trial. Because I would be prejudicing witnesses. I'd be prejudicing a jury. Well, that was the whole purpose of this raid, was to poison a jury, to hold me up as public enemy number one.
To use a cable news channel as a PR operation,
right,
to get their message out. So if they gag you and take your First Amendment rights away, does that mean that they're no longer allowed to leak to CNN against you?
Well, it's an interesting question. But the whole purpose of the gag would be so I don't poison a potential jury pool. But they've just poisoned a potential jury pool by making me look like El Chapo or Pablo Escobar.
But so it just seems a little bit one-sided. So they can arrest you with overwhelming force and automatic weapons and armored vehicles and stun grenades. And then they can force you not to speak in public, but they can still say whatever they want about you to news organizations
and leak. I mean, 2 years of leaks, as you know, that I was going to be arrested every other Tuesday, has destroyed my business. The censorship of my show on InfoWars and the censorship of my Facebook page has hurt my book sales dramatically. I'm a New York Times best-selling author. So this is part of the plan, destroy you financially. So like General Flynn, you have to plead guilty to something you didn't do.
Unbelievable. Well, you're always welcome on this show, gag order or not. Roger Stone, thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Next, we have Bill O'Reilly interviewing Brett Tolman. And they're tying up some loose ends like the Huber investigation and so forth. And even they're making some comments on the Stone, also a Roger Stone arrest. And so very, very interesting. This is coming from Bill O'Reilly on a short interview he had recently with Brett Tolman. So here we go with that interview now.
Brett Tolman is our go-to guy on all these things. He's in Utah, former U.S. attorney for Utah, and Huber is doing his job now. All right, I always ask you this, but it's very important. Am I making any mistakes in my analysis?
No, I haven't heard mistakes. I would add that Huber's mandate also involves the investigation of Carter Page. So I think there's an angle of his investigation that includes what happened with the Steele dossier and the FISA. At least I hope that that still is a component of his
investigation. And Horowitz is doing that too.
Correct.
So there's two of them doing the same thing.
That's right.
Was the FISA application to tap members of the Trump campaign illegal?
That's right.
And I think the evidence is overwhelming that it was.
And if it's not illegal, it is so blatantly disregards policy that it's corrupt.
So you have to fire the person that oversaw that, which was Comey and McCabe. You have to.
And if you have
to fire them, how can it be obstruction of justice if you're letting them go for cause?
Yeah, and you hit on that point, which is important. What nobody's talking about is the president has the authority to fire him. It would be one thing if you tried to exceed your authority, but how do you get obstruction when it falls exactly within his authority?
The only way you get obstruction in that case is if the president misused his authority because he felt that Comey was going to get him on a legitimate charge. That's the only way. All right, let's advance the story now. So you heard Carl yesterday.
Yes.
What did you think when you heard that?
You know, you and I talked about it. You know, we haven't been too bad at predicting some of this. At least we believed it would take a little longer than December, that it wasn't going to come out right before the new year. It seems to be, I think they are in the final stages of drafting the report. I think it was significant that Carl said that, but not surprising because there is so much weight that's been put on this report as the end-all be-all. That it's going to be anticlimactic, as you pointed out. I would also add, not only will it be anticlimactic, I believe that it will perhaps pose additional questions that are left unanswered. But keep in mind, he has to give that report to either Matt Whitaker, who is the acting attorney general, who then will prepare a summary that will be public, or to Bill Barr if he is confirmed prior to the report coming out. There is, statutorily, it is very different than an IG report, which is public, that does need to be disseminated. Here is going to be a special counsel.
There's a chain of command that has to be followed.
That's
but you
right.
know it's going to be leaked out. Look, no matter what's in the report, the hate
That's
Trump media is going to say it's horrible and Trump has to be impeached. We know that. All right,
yes.
But the folks now have had enough. So they're going to look at the facts. And there are enough people like me that and you that are going to report it fairly, all right, and honestly. That word will get out. I mean, we know what the hate Trump media is going to do, but that will be countered, and then the folks will have to see for themselves. Final question is, when you read the New York Times article, just as your experience as a U.S. attorney, and it basically said a sitting president was being investigated by the FBI for working for a foreign government at the same time he was president. Yet the article provided not one shred of evidence to back that up. It was only about the FBI did this, which they may have done. But that would have been, if they had done it, an abuse of power. But when you heard and saw that article, read that article, what did you think?
I thought that it is one of the more unusual scenarios because as U.S. attorney, for example, I received a referral that a sitting congressman had committed crimes. That has to be vetted at the very highest level of Department of Justice. And who brought it to me? The FBI did because they knew they had no authority to launch that kind of an investigation. And that's just a sitting member of the House of Representatives. Here you have the President of the United States.
No.
And that didn't go to the Department of Justice. That didn't go to a U.S. attorney in the district that they alleged there was crime.
The New York Times didn't even ask Rosenstein or Sessions or anybody, hey, did you okay this? Did you sign off on this? They didn't even ask him.
If the FBI did that, heads should roll. If they started an investigation and did that, heads should roll.
Right. And they couldn't do it because the protocol is their bosses at the Justice Department have to know about it.
That's
they
right.
have to know it. You can't just do it and
That's
keep
right.
it from them.
And by
so
way,
anyway,
by the way,
we always appreciate your time, Brett. You're one of the smartest guys around. Keep an eye on this. Anytime you have anything, please let us know. We'll throw you right on because I know this story is going to come fast and it's going to be confusing. That's why, you know, my audience comes and listens to you and me so they get the truth, and we will give you the truth. Thanks again, Brad. We appreciate it.
Coming up is Alex Jones talking about DM2. It's a hallucinogen. What's happening is that there's been a resurgence in the last few years about using these kinds of drugs on treating people that have mental disorders. So this we're getting into very, very dangerous territory. And Alex came forth with this week on this DMT, and he's got some very, very excellent ideas. So here we go with Alex.
Oh, yeah. 3 months ago, it was all over the news. CIA accidentally releases hundreds of pages about microwave radiation towers they were planning to put up in the 70s and conceal on universities to test mind control. But instead, they just hide them in plain view. That has a secondary service of digital data transfer, and then you pay for it. You know, I think because now I've been in this long enough that I might just tell people, too, because it's an important piece of the public, all about Stanley Kubrick tomorrow. Maybe I'll just tell you why Stanley Kubrick knew all those things and why he got visited by the Department of Defense and the CIA and others, and how they asked him to stop making movies about the things he saw. Let me give you a little hint of what I'm going to be breaking down tomorrow when I come up here all day and work on a very special, say, 10-minute report that'll be airing Sunday. Or I may just decide to go live tomorrow and put it out. Just watch Infowars.com and Newswars.com as this breaks. But I've got enough of the pieces to be 100% sure, and I'm ready to start getting into the next phase of what the globalists are going to do in specifics, who they are and what they want to build. And what I believe is going to be done to them after they have completed the project. But if you look at the heads of Google, the heads of Apple, the heads of Twitter, these are whacked out, drugged out prisoners. They are in a very serious drug cult. If you look at Heaven's Gate, he was a big computer programmer and involved with some of these people in the 60s and 70s that set this up. He just got whacked out and went and started his own cult. And it just shows that the drugs these people are taking, they have then communally had some type of mass hallucination, or there's some type of psychological compressed instinct in their epigenetics that every culture and every group keeps manifesting this blueprint. But the whole thing's been hiding in plain view forever. And the 60s and everything we've seen since then has been the revolution of this system coming in to control. And you see it foreshadowed by Arthur C. Clarke in Childhood's End. You see it foreshadowed by the Fabian Socialist and their future societies. And I've got to sit back here 170 years into their project, about 168 years into the first declarations of the project. And I've got to say, they've had incredible success and had incredible advanced technology and knowledge, which means one of two things. One of two things. It either means the species is from another planet and we have compressed ancestral memories that we're then manifesting again of something that went wrong. We're repeating history. Or the information is being beamed, being transmitted through another dimension or through this dimension, into the mind. And I've talked a lot about this, but you have to understand something. They never attack me on this in the news. They'll make stuff up and say that I say that there's slave colonies on Mars. Never said that. They'll say that I'm sending people to Sandy Hook parents' houses to harass them. Never did that. I'm on the cover of Texas Monthly this month, and it's just a huge list of lies. And you say, why would they do that? Why would they say a bunch of things I never said or never did? And then pick a few things I did say, but then act like I'm lying about it. Why would they do that? And it's because I have been exposing just obliquely the psychedelic DMT cult that obviously has tried to recruit me many times and has offices right here in Austin run by the CIA. I think tomorrow I'm just, for my own safety, I think I'm going to release it. You know what? I don't think I'm going to release it all tomorrow. You know what? I might just do it today. Because here's what I'm getting at. I have thousands of data points. I know about the secret project at the University of Texas to produce advanced mind control drugs that they're already testing on the student population on the black market. I know who represents them. I know the entire plan. You see, you can't get away from me. I don't need to have sources. I have the sources, and then I ask the questions and get the answers because people know I know. Oh, yeah, 3 months ago, it was all over the news. CIA accidentally releases hundreds of pages about microwave radiation towers they were planning to put up in the 70s and conceal on universities to test mind control. But instead, they just hide them in plain view that has a secondary service of digital data transfer, and then you pay for it. You know, I think because now I've been in this long enough that I might just tell people, too, because it's an important piece of the public, all about Stanley Kubrick tomorrow. Maybe I'll just tell you why Stanley Kubrick knew all those things and why he got visited by the Department of Defense and the CIA and others and how they asked him to stop making movies about the things he saw. Kubrick was so psychic that he was able to know the exact name and codes of B-52 nuclear launch scrambler systems without ever being told, without ever seeing it. And the big secret was he saw it. So, I'm not going to put up with this crap anymore, and I'm going to release everything. And I'm going to do it tomorrow. So get ready. And all these little subcults and all these little groups that think they're part of the winning team because you've joined the system, the globalists hate your guts and want to kill you. And they are killing you. And you look at the slaves they've got in Congress, those Democrats particularly, and you look at the slaves in Hollywood, everybody ought to be thanking God. You're not part of Silicon Valley. You're not part of the Chi-Coms. You're not part of the EU. Everybody who's been taught to feel inadequate because you're not part of the system, you ought to thank God every day that you're not part of this devil system because you are going to inherit the earth when this thing has been destroyed. And it will be destroyed. It only acts on our free will, tricking us to give it power. But we're going to defeat it together. It has a name.
Alex Jones has pioneered in many of these far-reaching exposés, I should say. So he has some very, very excellent ideas about what the whole system, the world system, is really about. Now, this is just a short clip on DMT, but it's very dangerous, these drugs are. And, of course, LSD started out in the 60s as being used by psychiatrists for treatment of mentally ill patients. And then now we're seeing a resurgence somehow from psychiatrists and psychologists that, yeah, we ought to start using these DMT and other drugs to treat mentally ill people. It's never worked out right. Some of these drugs will create psychotic fits in people. And the psychiatric drugs and the psychotropic drugs have that tendency to do that. So they're dangerous. They're very dangerous drugs. But the pharmaceuticals are making multi-millions and to the billions of dollars from these drugs. So that's why they continue to push it. We're going to be covering some Venezuela. That's what's going to be coming up next. I'm going to be bringing us up to date on what's going down there in just a second. So get ready to listen to a little bit about Venezuela. So here we go in just a second. A top general recently has come over to the opposition side, and he's stating right now that there are others involved that want to defect. But this latest, you could say, information is about General Francisco Yanez of the Air Force's high command. And he's saying that that he is supporting Juan Guaido. That is the leader coming in out of the parliament there. So he's a top level general. And then also we have a mutiny at the central bank that seems to be going on. And what's happening there is that Maduro wanted to ship out 20 tons of gold, and there's resistance to doing that. And there's a good article on Zero Hedge that covered that also. And then in addition to that, we have some Hugo Chavez people. He's the previous president of Venezuela. And there were supporters of Hugo Chavez that are now turning against Maduro and saying that he needs to be ousted. But they are wanting to do it peacefully. So hopefully this revolt that's ongoing in Venezuela will be settled peacefully. But, you know, you never know. And the United States, Russia is saying for us to stay out militarily or they're going to do something. This is our hemisphere. We used to have a Monroe Doctrine that prohibited anyone from coming in to our sphere of influence here. But I guess maybe that's come and gone. There's another bit of news also about an Iranian national security advisor, okay? And what's interesting about that is that he's recently fled the country, okay? And his name is Tora Esmaili. He's a top advisor working for the cyber and missile department of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. And the story goes that he fled with hundreds of documents and holed up in Turkey in a very high-level avant-garde Tashkent hotel. And then the local intelligence, along with the Iranian intelligence agency, found out where he was and went after him, and they missed him. So what that's going to manifest or result in is that there are documents that are being smuggled out through these defections, you could say, by some top intelligence operatives about some of the projects probably that are happening in Iran itself. There's some other evidence also that the Banyad support network, and that's the revolutionary, the Iranian revolutionary force there that is beginning to, what happened was the Banyad name word means foundation. And when the Shah was deposed and taken out and Khomeini and them came in with a new regime to replace him, and he fled with his family to the West, there were these foundations that Shah had set up. And these foundations had accumulated vast fortunes of assets and treasures. And so Khomeini and them didn't dismantle some of these. They took them over and just expanded them. And so, you know, there's been unrest in Iran in the last year or so. And it appears to be that this unrest, I could say, you could trace it back to what some of these foundations have been doing. Some writers are saying that these foundations control about 35% of the economy. And so they're coming in and they're tax free. They don't disclose what they're doing. They portray themselves as charitable organizations, but they have virtually thousands and tens of thousands of people working for them that are on the payroll of some of these foundations. So what's happened is that the mullahs then have actually set up these mechanisms called foundations, and they got control over and ownership of the top banks. But they set up this foundation system along with financial organizations to enrich themselves. That's what really is going on in Iran. I think there have been, if you consult Twitter, you'll see some tweets put up. And there's one particular person in there that's tweeting about some of this unrest and these protests that are happening all over Iran. And I would say that it can be traced back possibly to this. Other articles you'll read in Iran about Iran say that the cost of living and the cost of eggs and just living and eating is getting more tenuous too. So it appears that things like this are happening not only, say, in Iran, but the French are protesting that they can't make a living. And they're having a hard time feeding their families. So it's not only happening there, but in the UK, you have people there that are experiencing cost of living increases too. So it's not just in one or two countries. It appears that the revolt that is happening, these revolts, I could say, because it's more than one, are happening all across the globe. And they're happening in Europe right now. The focus is these yellow vests. I call them yellow jackets. And they're the most profoundly outspoken in their protest. And there was a protest today by the yellow vest in Paris and in multiple French cities throughout France. So it's not over with. And the clip I played a little bit earlier showed that the yellow jackets or the yellow vest are demonstrating and protesting because the cost of living, they're having a hard time just making a living and eating. Well, this also would coincide with what other people are protesting in other countries also. And Iran, you know, it's not even close to Europe. It's outside of Europe. They're running into the same problems. So we've had a series of people take over these countries through revolt or war or whatever. And then they've converted and enriched themselves through those existing governmental systems. But, you know, they'll use whatever they can to mesmerize the total population or the public at large. Like, for example, they'll use religion as a means by which to pacify and submit, make those people submit to government authorities, see. And that's what it appears to be that's happening in Iran. Iran has one of the largest and young populations. I think there's about 50% of the people under 35 in Iran. And I think they still have connections to the West. We've had these sanctions that have been placed on Iran by the Trump administration, even though the Europeans have not been in agreement on the sanctions against Iran. And Iran had been using some of these foundations through different companies that are outside our sphere of influence or control to continue their trade of oil and so forth. I know way back several years ago, well, we caught the Turks in their, you know, facilitating the sale of Iran's oil for gold. See, so this is a cauldron of very unscrupulous people in the Middle East trading with each other. They've been there for centuries, and so when we try to come in and impose these sanctions, they don't always work, and so that's what's happening in Iran right now. And I don't know what the final outcome is gonna be. We've got this Northrum, that he backtracks on this apology. There was a picture of him possibly in Klan clothing. I don't know. He's backing off of that now. He's the, governor of Virginia. Virginia governor now says not him in photograph. He won't resign. That's the headline on Drudge. We've had all the TS agent commit suicide at Orlando Airport. We had this Venezuelan general announce his defection. It goes on and on and on. And I just don't know where it's going to end peaceably. We have in France, and I'll go back to the fire in the minds of men, is that in the 1700s in France, we had the intelligentsia of the journalist develop because of the printing press between 1700 and 1800 and the early 1800s. The printing press began to be much more efficient because it was much more efficient than a plethora of publications in France about socialism and communism and the word also, communitarianism, shows up. Nikki Rapana has written extensively about communitarianism, and she's the go-to lady on communitarianism. But this Etzioni fella here in this country is pushing that big time. The communitarianism is a workaround to bring us communism, but in a way of community rights over individual rights. So be very wary of people that are bringing us this communitarianism. I want to thank everybody out there in our listening audience for listening and helping to and continuing to support us. We don't always have all the right answers all the time, but we're trying to bring about and affect a better understanding overall of something called truth, you know. And it's not always easy to arrive at or to discern or to establish. You have so much confusion out there, and you have so many learned people with all kinds of predisposed ideas about what they've learned in the universities and colleges. And what they've learned there are means, in many cases, to continue to control them through a curriculum that they picked up out there at the universities. And that's not always correct. And the psychology is there. You speak to one of these college graduates, you're speaking to many, because they've all been conditioned and programmed into a very, very similar, you could say, thinking. But anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we certainly appreciate each and every one of you. And life is precious, and we love and respect everyone. Thank you. Good night.